Today's podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
All right, let's get back in here on Diamond Conversations, another episode here on the Place to Be Nation podcasting network. If you did know by now, my name is Ian, and every single week we sit down to have a Diamond Conversation with somebody from the world of baseball. And this week we go a little bit closer to home as we tap back into the Middletown, New Jersey roots of the show as we welcome in minor league outfield and base running coordinator for the Boston Red Sox, the pride of the Middletown South Eagles, the legendary, the great, Mr. Darren Fenster. Darren, thanks for coming on today.
Thanks, Ian, and you're way too kind. there's a lot of people out of the school that would take offense to that introduction, but nonetheless, I appreciate it.
No, it's all right, because I'm looking for my Hall of Fame induction somewhere down the road for the podcasting endeavors, but we'll talk about that at another time. But it's great to have you on, man. You know, just as we're getting ready to record, Doug has to bring up to the forefront right away. We were going to have him save it for the year, but he jumped the gun a little bit. Of course, the statistician extraordinaire, Mr. Doug Barclay. Doug interviewed you back in the day for the high school newspaper as he was still attending Middletown South, and did a great spread on you. And it's kind of cool to have you guys reunite here like 10 plus years later. So very nice to have you guys reunited.
Yeah, if that was 2005, that was just either, that was the year I got hurt. I actually didn't play after that. So that was right at the very end of one career and then the start of this one.
Doug, what are your memories of a teenager getting the chance to talk to a South alumni and kind of getting the vibes to dial into what he was doing after high school at that point? What was your retrospective on that?
You know, I tried finding it to kind of compare and contrast the perspectives of your career over the years. I remember us talking a lot about David DeJesus, who I think was one of your boys who was still playing at that point. And having a nice little run there, but a lot's happened since then, and definitely want to get into that.
Yeah, 15 years, a lot tends to happen over time.
That's crazy.
But also just the way that the game is played, the game is interpreted, and how you've gone about it from coaching, and just kind of went back looking at some of the guys that you had in the Red Sox system over the last few years. I mean, your Brett Attendees, your Michael Chavis. I mean, a lot of guys that have had success at that major league roster, came through you first.
Yeah, it's been very fortunate to been in, to latch on with the Red Sox back in 2012, and having a number of different roles over the past 9 years has really allowed me to understand what the organization is all about, how all the different levels flow, how the departments work together, and at the end of the day, notwithstanding what's going on this year, the general expectations are for us to compete for a World Series every single year and to be a part of one of, only a handful of organizations in the game that has that approach. They're going to bring in the best amateur players that they can. And if we have some holes, we try to fill with free agents. And, the Boston market isn't necessarily one that rebuilds. And even though we're going through some challenges this year, I think generally speaking, it's been a really cool experience to be a part of an organization that expects, that holds itself to the higher standards.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the history is second to none. Maybe one or two teams that have that storied history that the Red Sox franchise does. But what do you take this so far with the 2020 season? Obviously, for the minor leagues, it's a little different. Some players are on the expanded roster, but how are you kind of taking this season and viewing it as a whole?
Yeah, I mean, you could take this season much like society can take the year. It's been nothing like anybody has ever experienced before. Nobody could prepare for it. With regard to our minor leaguers, there is no minor league season. And so if guys are not involved with our alternate site, where we have a handful of minor league guys who have yet to break into the big leagues, the majority of our minor league players are going to lose an entire year of development. And we're trying to come up with some creative ways to continue to help them push forward with their own careers, even though we're not together and they don't have the luxury of 140 games and all the things that come with a normal minor league season. But what something like this presents is really, you know, it's just a different kind of an opportunity where guys are very much on their own in a lot of respects, and ownership takes such a huge role right now, where because we're not around them and because we're not working with them every day, they're going to have more of a say of how they get better over the course of this year if we don't get together again until spring training of next year, where you're going to see guys report who have really made some strides, whether it be physically just working out and becoming more athletic or baseball specific. And at the same time, you're probably going to see some guys in the industry who really don't do much of anything and show up out of shape and did not get better or maybe regress in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, it's really just like an extended off season where we experience these things every year in spring training, but we're talking about 4 or 5 months away as opposed to an entire year. And we're all just really excited to, you know, press fast forward and get to 2021, where we could at least have some semblance of a normal minor league season again and get back to doing what we all love.
So, absolutely.
I have one question for you about that. We talked to a pitcher in the Rays organization, a guy named Simon Rosenboom Larson. He also runs the organization More Than Baseball that does a lot of minor leaguers. And he talked about, you know, the importance of, if it can happen, the Arizona Fall League. Do you think that teams will be more likely to push guys, you know, to go off in that sort of experience if the Fall League can happen? Or do you think it's better to sort of, you know, just keep on what you're doing? Don't reintroduce, you know, full play until you have the full organization behind you in the spring?
Well, I think everybody wants opportunities to play, whether that's in the Fall League, whether that's winter ball, whether that is during the traditional instructional league that takes place middle of September to the middle of October. Again, like, these guys have been away since the middle of March and they haven't had any true baseball structure that the traditional sense of the year would give them. So if we're able to have any of those opportunities, I guarantee you all 30 clubs would jump at that chance. But, you know, I don't think it's so simple as just saying, hey, you guys want to have a fall league this year. Yeah. There are so many things that play into it beyond just, you know, what's going on in the country with the virus. And you're talking about bringing people in from all over the world in one place. And, you know, Arizona and Florida, you know, I haven't really kept up to date every day with what's going on in those specific regions, but, you know, they were fine. And now, you know, over the summer they had some serious spikes. So this thing changes things day to day, week to week. So, you know, we could be planning for a full on instructional league. And then a week from now, because of what's going on in the virus, we may not be able to do that. So yeah. I think that's the uncertainty has had a huge impact, not just on baseball, but on, you know, really society as a whole in terms of, you know, what you can and can't do and when you can and can't do it. But in terms of baseball people wanting to get back doing baseball things, like, you know, there's, I think, unanimous consensus that everybody wants to. I think similar to like opening schools, like a very controversial topic right now. And I don't think anybody, you know, in a vacuum doesn't want school to be open. Nobody doesn't want their kids to go to school. And I think it's just a matter of figuring out, you know, how to best do it where, you know, you're able to do it in a safe manner and have productive days. And I don't think, you know, that's much different for how people are approaching the restart in baseball, whenever that's going to be.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, I mean, from a coaching perspective, this really has to kind of test you a little bit too, because, you know, you're worried about what some guys may be doing kind of outside your bubble, so to speak. You know, you have to reach out to them, I'm sure, at certain points and check in with guys. But, you know, you're a very motivational guy. You know, you share a lot of motivational quotes and a lot of great, you know, aspects of the game that people should really think about. Is this tapping into your coaching ability and seeing how you kind of foster and take care of these guys along the way?
I don't think there's any question about it, because I mean, this is the epitome of what adversity is. You know, we are all out of our comfort zones. We're not doing things the way that we are used to doing them. So I think it's kind of forced us, you know, as a society, really, you know, to find different ways to continue to move the needle. And, you know, that's no different in our organization. And we've tried a handful of different things, ways to engage our players, ways to be able to help them remotely. You know, we have, you know, we've been having Zoom calls in various groups, various departments within the organization, various things that we've done as a staff to continue staff development. And, you know, all said and told, none of this stuff would be going on in the sense that it's happening now if we weren't in the middle of a pandemic. So I think in that respect, it's a positive in the sense that it forces you to adapt, and it forces you to, you know, rather than just quit because things aren't necessarily easy or perfect, you are trying to, you know, get outside of what you normally do in order to still have an impact on people. And, you know, that's the big picture of what we do. Yeah, we're coaching a game, and it's what our passions are. But I think once you're in it for a while and you get some perspective, you realize how much bigger it is than just, you know, the just baseball on a, you know, out on an island.
What's been the maybe the most trying part of that, you know, come along with the successes of talking to guys and maybe helping out where you can? Like, what's been the hardest part about this whole process?
Well, it's probably twofold. I mean, just not doing what you love. You know, people talk about teams and organizations like families, and I can't speak for the other 29 organizations, but, you know, people throw it around a lot, but in every sense, like, the Red Sox organization is a family, and I've been with the club for 9 years, and some of the relationships that I've built with these people is as close, if not closer, than some of my closest friends and family. And then you get into the team element of being together with the same group of 25, 30, 35 guys over the course of 5 months. And that builds some incredible bonds, and you go through ups and downs together, and you have people to lean on every single day. And, you know, those relationships and that dynamic has been completely taken away from us. So I think that in and of itself is the biggest challenge. And with that challenge, I think, just keeping guys motivated, to the sense of when a season is lost, when something is canceled, like, that's a really deflating thing for, you know, in the entire game, thousands of players who were looking forward to this year as a year to get better and a year to, hopefully get one step closer to the big leagues, if not actually getting to the big leagues. And, to no fault of their own, it was taken away from them. And, you know, that's when things are taken away from you, and at no fault of your own, I think that's a pretty deflating feeling. And so that can take away from just, you know, as these guys, it could take away from their dream and their inner drive to really continue to pursue it. And so I think a big part of what we've tried to do over the course of the summer has not necessarily been baseball specific, but really trying to keep guys engaged and keep guys motivated, because if we're able to do those things, then everything on the baseball side will take care of itself.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I mean, I love minor league baseball as it is. I love watching the development of guys. I love seeing them come through the systems and the organizations. So, I mean, we talk about and we hear about MLB service time and guys, you know, that'll be still able to walk, even though there's only been 60 games. I think that the thing that people should focus on are the kids that are losing a full year in development, and whether a guy was on the cusp of getting called up and, you know, maybe has to go back to Double A starting next year. It's tough, and it could change the course of careers. And I'm sure that's a giant thing weighing on a lot of people, like in your positions, minds, that you don't want to get these guys to lose any kind of motivation and regress.
Yeah. At the end of the day, these guys, everybody is talented. If you got drafted, even if you're the last pick of the draft, if you signed as a minor league free agent who was from a different country or whatever, just that alone puts you in the top 1% of 1% of people who play baseball. So these guys are are really, really good. And, you know, there's only one Mike Trout, a guy whose talent is just better than everybody else. And you throw what that kid's makeup is on top of, you have elite makeup with elite talent, and you get one of the best players that has ever played the game. So generally speaking, like, you don't get to that point of getting an opportunity to play professional baseball, whether you're a first rounder or a 50th rounder, by not being motivated. So this is, you know, part of most of these guys' DNA. There are very few players who are so good and have no motivation to do it, because it's really hard and it takes a lot of work. You know, if you take that part out of the equation, then you're talking about, you know, something that's really hard, that's going to become just that much harder. And so that's why I feel the motivational aspect is as important as anything we're doing right now, because when you got that part down, a lot of the other things take care of itself.
Like I said, you're very, very motivational with the stuff that you share online. And it's very cool to see. And I love the quotes that come out there, because you never know where they're coming from. But let's go back in time a little bit. Let's talk about you, the draft itself. So 12th round of the 2000 draft. Now, again, we talked about the local feeling of this interview and being, you know, on a home turf here, Middletown, New Jersey. Middletown, you grew up in Met Yankee territory. You know, I feel like our area growing up always had little ins and outs of baseball camps and places that you could go. And we always saw those kinds of players that would go into the traveling teams and this and that. But here's the 12th round of the 2000 draft. Take us back to that night and getting drafted by the Kansas City Royals and what that feeling was like, and who was the one to call you to tell you?
Well, the draft in 2000 was much different than it is today. There was nothing on TV. Everything was, I believe, done on a webcast. And that might have been like the web broadcast was the first year that they might have done it in that respect. Because I had actually, that was my senior year, and I was hopeful that I was going to get drafted after my junior year in 1999. You know, for whatever reason, that didn't happen. And I remembered in 1999, really staying at home for 3 days, sitting around waiting for my phone to ring, and it rang off the hook from all my buddies asking me, you know, when I got drafted. But I never got a call from a single major league team telling me that I'd gotten drafted. So that was my first draft experience, and it was very stressful, and it was pretty miserable when, you know, you're expecting to get picked up and you don't. So you know, I'm sure if the option was to listen to it on the computer, you could have, but I don't remember that even being an option in 1999. So fast forward to 2000, they have the webcast, and, you know, I put it on, and I was, you know, the house computer was in my brother's room. So I was just sitting up there the whole time. And, you know, as the rounds go on, like, you know, when you're a senior, you really don't have any true sense of where you may go. You know, you could, if the right team likes you at the right time, you could go pretty early, or, you know, someone may just take a flyer on you in the 30th round or whatever it is. And so, you know, I just remembered it was a very, very anxious time, you know, waiting to hear your name called. And I had a good sense that it was going to happen. I had reassurances, not from professional teams, but there was a lot more interest prior to the draft from some teams where I felt like this was going to happen. And then, you know, as you kind of get into the draft and you start hearing some of the names that are being selected, guys you're really familiar with, you know, you just sense that it's going to happen a little bit sooner. And then, you know, thankfully the Royals called my name in the 12th round. You know, my mom and dad were in the house, and, you know, they were kind of periodically coming in and out of the room. And then when that happened, you know, they were jumping for joy, and were probably more excited than I was at the time, just because they had known how much I had put into it. And then, you know, within a couple minutes, Keith Hughes was the scout who had drafted me from the Royals. He called me to, congratulate me and, you know, tell me what the next steps were. And then, you know, this next part of my life was about to begin.
It's quite the draft class. I mean, just going up and down the rounds. I mean, it is like, it is a who's who, you know, to see who came out of that, that draft class. And it's just amazing to think that that's all the way back in 2000. To me, it feels like yesterday. I'm sure it might feel like that in some way, shape or form to you, but, to joining the Kansas City Royals organization, what was that like in getting your first taste of, you know, being with a pro squad?
It was really unique. My first summer, I went out to Spokane, Washington, and I got a true minor league experience where we were drawing 5,000-6,000 people a night. I was living with a host family, and I had two roommates, one guy who played at Nebraska and another guy who I played against at Texas Tech. And still to this day, like two of my closer friends who I came up with. And then the following year, I was in Burlington, Iowa, which was a completely different minor league experience where we were only drawing 300-400 fans a night. And I was in the middle of nowhere. You drive through 3 hours worth of cornfields before you know, get to the next city. Somehow I was able to put together a decent year. And then, the following year in 2002, our high A affiliate was in Wilmington, Delaware, which was great because it was only a little bit more than an hour away from where we lived. So this was the first time that, you know, my friends and family could actually come see me play. And, you know, as things would turn out, I don't know if subconsciously I just enjoyed having friends and family play, but I got stuck playing in Wilmington for parts of 3 years. And anybody who is trying to become a big leaguer, if you get stuck in A ball for parts of 3 years, it's not necessarily a badge of honor. You learn a lot about how minor league baseball works and how opportunities work. And there were a lot of times where I didn't have the role on the team and getting the opportunities that I thought I deserved at the time. I understand those way more now being on the other side of it. But in 2002, I had gotten off to a really good start and made the all-star team. And then maybe 2 days before the all-star game, I broke my finger, got hit by a pitch, missed 6 weeks, came back and really struggled the rest of the year. So the following year, they sent me back to Wilmington, and I really struggled the entire year. Just couldn't put it together at all. I got hit in the head by a pitch at one point in the middle of the year, and that knocked me out for a few weeks. So just, I never got into any sense of a groove. But as a player, I was versatile. I played a number of different positions. I was, you know, I think always considered a decent clubhouse guy. Some coaches like would always say that, you know, I was one of those guys who was like having an extra coach on their staff as a player. And, you know, that probably kept me around where other guys with my performance would have been released. Fast forward to 2014, start the year for my third consecutive year in Wilmington. And finally things click. I'm leading the league in hitting at the All-Star break, go to the All-Star game. A few weeks later, I go to Double-A and just finish the year on a strong note. And the next year I'm in Major League spring training. So it's incredible how quick things changed and how quick things changed from the positive side. With a week left in spring training in 2005, I jumped for a ball like I had done a million times. And when I landed, my leg went one way, my knee went the other. And just like that, my season was over before we knew it. So I truly had the ups and downs that so many professionals go through on so many different levels, from the performance perspective to just learning how to not play GM and control what you can control and put your effort into daily work. And, you know, I saw the fruits of that labor over time. And, you know, not everybody gets to the big leagues, and you know, there's nothing I can really look back on and say, hey, I wish I'd done something a little bit different, because, you know, hindsight 2020 with where I've gotten to now, like, it's all worked out for the better.
So with your knee injury, though, and you say it was something that you've done a million times, what did they say was different about either the landing or how you went about it? What was the kind of the prognosis of what happened?
I mean, I don't know what was any different about the jump, but when I came down, like, it had felt like somebody had shot the back of my knee with a shotgun. Like, I'd never felt pain like that before in my life. So I knew it was serious. I hoped it was just some kind of a sprain. And then the next day I had an MRI and they revealed like an ACL tear. In addition to the tear, I had a tibial plateau fracture and some cartilage damage. So I really did three significant things in one jump. And then so I had surgery and then lived out in Arizona rehabbing the whole year, went back to spring training in 2006. And while I was medically cleared, I was nowhere near the level that I was at previously. And in the business side of the game, where there's always a lot of turnover and there's always someone trying to take your job, guys have passed me on the depth chart and they were ready to move on. And that's, you know, that's what they wound up doing. So, you know, didn't work out as we had all planned, but you know, sometimes the life plan isn't how you write it up.
Yeah. Oh no, absolutely. I mean, that's, I can't imagine what you feel like, but B, I mean, you've had a great, you know, coaching career so far. And obviously there's going to be a lot more for you to come. We will talk about that. But I just want to ask too, with the rehab, so did you have to change your game at all to kind of take care of the knee a little bit more at that point as you were on the way back?
My rehab, you know, I can't really say I had to change my game because I got released and never really played again after that. So, you know, I just remember the rehab was incredibly challenging, incredibly painful. Right before spring training, so I probably lived in Arizona until November, and then came home for a few months, for the winter. And then I remember, you know, I would work out at Rutgers, and be able to use their facilities. And I just remembered a few weeks before leaving for spring training again that my knee just didn't feel right. But fortunately, once I got out into some warm weather, it finally felt like it was sturdy and in a good place. And a lot of that, like, daily aches and pains had kind of dissipated. So, you know, I was just hopeful that I was going to get the time to be able to get back to the level that I was at previously. And, you know, it took me a while to, you know, kind of get back into the swing of things physically on a baseball perspective in spring training. Didn't perform great. And, you know, unfortunately, I wasn't afforded the time to get back to that level. And that's just the nature of the business side of the game sometimes. And, you know, hindsight 2020, Coach Hill at Rutgers was the second person I probably called after. You know, I told my folks that I had gotten released, and immediately Coach Hill said, "Hey, I think you have a chance to be a pretty good coach. And if you're interested, I'll create a spot for you on our staff," because they didn't have the director of baseball operations at that time. So who knows how timing would have worked out if, you know, maybe I'd been kept and extended and been able to stay, you know, and get back to, you know, a stronger version of myself. You know, maybe my career lasts another few months, maybe it lasts a few years. Who knows? Maybe I'm still in the big leagues today at 41. Who the hell knows? But, you know, when the timing happened, you know, it just so worked out that Coach Hill had the opportunity to create a spot for me, which, you know, essentially changed the whole direction of my life beyond playing.
Absolutely. And I think when we were going to kind of go back again, back into the minor league days, just talk about your first manager and getting a chance to play. Doug, you want to jump in here? I know you were waiting to fly.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's so many things that are different about, you know, different generations of baseball, and just kind of looking through your stuff. I mean, your first manager, you're the first manager for a lot of great players. You know, your first manager was Tom Paquette, who had a nice career in the big leagues. His first manager in the minor leagues was a guy that played in the 40s. So this is kind of, you know, three different generations of baseball that gets easily passed down based off who you came in first. You know, what are some of the similar things that you picked up on, you know, in your minor league career that were most important for you to impart to guys when you first get them, when, you know, it's their first experience in organized ball?
So my perspective of, you know, the guys I played for in the minor leagues deals far more with how they interacted with me than anything baseball specific. So my baseball foundation started with my father in my backyard. He was my first coach all the way up through Little League. And then, you know, the influence that Coach Hill had on me in 4 years at Rutgers, really that combination gave me just such a great fundamental base from which to grow from. So that, as a coach now myself, like, that's at the core of who I am and what I teach. But, you know, one of the things that really stuck out, you know, Coach Hill was very, very hands-on. He demanded a lot of us. He held us to a very high standard. You know, he was a hard ass, very old, you know, the traditional old school coach. And certain guys in professional baseball did not take that hands-on approach. And that was just, it just wasn't their style. It didn't mean that they were a bad coach or a good coach. It was just different. And that took some time getting used to. And I remember playing for Tom Pulchetta as a guy who, you know, he was more of a guide. You know, he was not hands-on. He kind of just let us play. And, you know, it was something that was completely different, a different environment than what I had been used to. And now as a coach myself, one of the things that we consciously communicate when we first draft players to our coaches is to not touch them, in the sense of, hey, we're giving them their first experience in professional baseball. We want them to get their feet wet. We drafted them for a reason. So let them get their feet wet for a few weeks, a month, whatever it is, before we really start trying to make some adjustments, because, you know, nobody who gets drafted is the same player that they are when they get to the big leagues. Everybody needs things to improve on. So that was literally the experience that I had as a first year player. And I didn't understand it then, but I do now. And then, you know, spending 6 years with the Royals, you know, I was fortunate to cross paths with some really great baseball guys. And the ones who I enjoyed being around the most were the ones who treated me like I was a first round draft pick, in the sense that it didn't matter what my prospect status was, or what, you know, what, how much money I signed for, or where I got drafted. They saw a guy in a uniform, and that guy was going to get their best attention in order to help get them better. And not everybody was like that. So that was something that really made an impression on me as a guy who was never a top prospect, who got a ton of money. You know, but that's not to say guys with that profile can't go on to the big leagues and have really successful careers. So, you know, one of the things that, you know, I really pride myself on, and I hope if you were to ask any of my former players this, that if they said, hey, like, did Darren treat you any differently than he did a first rounder, or vice versa, I would like to think they would say no, that I gave those guys the best of me to try to get them better. And my background as a player is a direct influence on that.
So what do you kind of feel is like the best contrasting coaching style? Is it a little bit of that old school mixed with some of that, you know, guiding, or is it you got to be one or you got to be the other? Do you think they can mesh well to make like a perfect coach?
I think there's balance in everything that we do. You know, there's a narrative right now that says, like, you know, old school is bad. You know, the game has changed. The game hasn't changed. You know, the bases are still 90 feet apart. The team who scores more runs is the team that wins. The idea on offense, you try to score runs. The idea on defense, you try to prevent runs. That hasn't changed. What's changed is just, you know, how we look at the game and how we evaluate the game. What's changed is, you know, the personalities of players and the things that they have access to growing up, in the sense that, you know, the influence, for example, that Coach Hill had on me, like, kids, you know, it's rare for that, for a kid to get that kind of experience. So that's going to change who they are at the core. And I think, you know, I've always believed that if something works, it works, whether it was created, yesterday with, you know, the most advanced technology, or if it was created 50 years ago before there was technology in the game. You know, I truly believe that. And one of the things that I think is getting lost in coaching today is that, you know, people don't necessarily have their core values in terms of what they're going to do, because they are constantly trying to be the next best thing, to have the next tech to give them the best advantage. But I think if you are constantly changing your approach, and if you're constantly changing your beliefs, then you don't really stand for much. So I unequivocally would say that I'm constantly tweaking and adapting, and I'm not the same coach I was a year ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. But I would also say that my core beliefs of the things that I believe make successful players are stand true today as they did, you know, the day that I started coaching. And, you know, sometimes it's just figuring out different ways to teach those things, you know, as the game has advanced in a lot of different ways, where we have access to information and technology and devices that can get to the same point, just maybe by taking a little bit of a different road.
Oh, without a doubt. And before we get into the wrap up, and we'll talk about a little more of the current stuff, I just want to go back to Rutgers if we can. And I know Coach Hill passed away in 2019. And, you know, I know the Rutgers, if you went to Rutgers or people who played at Rutgers, it's like you're married to Rutgers forever. And there's a love for the university and the teams and everything. But just talk about the Rutgers experience and Coach Hill. And obviously he's made such an influence on you and helped you out at a time when you were in a transition. So kind of talk about the Rutgers experience if you can, and paint that picture, because it sounds like, you know, you have an undying love for those Scarlet Knights.
Yeah. Well, I spent 10 years of my life at Rutgers. So that's, you know, essentially a quarter of my time on earth, you know, at Rutgers. And, you know, anybody who has been to Rutgers is very familiar with the RU screw and the challenges that come with, you know, being a student there, being, you know, a part of the university. But, you know, with Coach Hill having passed away last year and, getting, you know, you reconnect with some guys in unfortunate circumstances that, you know, otherwise you wouldn't have, and you start talking about, your time together as, you know, as teammates, as players. And then, you know, there were former players that had come back that I had coached, and just reminiscing about that. And, you know, to be perfectly honest with you, like, my affinity for Rutgers is more an affinity for Coach Hill than it is anything else, because, you know, he was the one who made the experience what it was for me. And I spent 4 years playing for him. I spent 6 years coaching with him. So, you know, to me, you know, Rutgers is Coach Hill for me. And the guy was like a second father to me. So all my greatest memories at Rutgers, you know, short of the things that were done with my buddies, you know, were a direct result of being around Coach Hill for 10 years. And, you know, that's when he left the program, I think you really saw how much he actually did and the connection that he gave so many of us to the university and to the program as a whole.
Yeah, a near 30-year run. I mean, that's like that's not easy to have that and have success and to make the impact is fantastic. But let's kind of just transition back to what's going on in the future. So obviously you're in the Red Sox organization. You know, do you still have aspirations to manage and to kind of move that career along as well?
Yeah, I mean, I love managing. When I transitioned to this role as a coordinator, where my responsibility is essentially overseeing the outfield and base running chunk of our entire minor league system from AAA all the way down to the Dominican, while we're syncing up with what our major league staff and front office are looking for out of our outfielders and base runners, I miss managing. You know, I love being in the grind with players. You know, I love 5 months worth of building relationships with guys, going through the ups and downs, the competitive side of every game, coaching third base, those sorts of things. I truly love, and I'm sure at some point I'll probably get back into that side of it. But over the course of my time managing, I really became intrigued by the culture element and the roles that leadership plays in, you know, a team really just working together or not working together. And so in that scope, what this role allows me to do, it still allows me to really dive into that cultural element. But rather than being with a minor league affiliate to build something, I'm able to build something with the organization as a whole, to the degree of, hey, what are we going to be all about as base runners? What are we going to be all about as outfielders, to the point where, you know, we want to have our staples that kind of define who we are. And when those standards aren't necessarily met, they don't need me or a coach to address those situations. You know, they hold each other accountable. And this was the second year going into that role. And, you know, the first year was spent doing a lot of evaluating, doing a lot of things, trying to see what sticks and what direction we wanted to go in. And this year it was really kind of taking that to another level. And unfortunately, you know, we had to press pause on that. But at the core of, you know, the things that interest me and the things that really, you know, inspire me to do my job, you know, whether it's developing a team and a culture within an affiliate clubhouse or doing that for an entire organization, I feel like I'm able to do that. And, you know, everything that I've been able to accomplish in terms of different roles and different going from being a minor league rookie ball manager to A ball to double A to now being a coordinator, I never approached one role with the idea of trying to get another. The reason why I've gotten all these opportunities and been promoted from one to the next have been a direct byproduct of me just trying to be the best hitting coach that I could possibly be. And in the process of doing that, they said, hey, you could be a pretty good manager in rookie ball. And then I'm like, cool, I'm managing in rookie ball. And it was just be the best rookie ball manager I could be. And, you know, they saw enough to say, all right, he's ready for A ball. He's ready for double A. And then, you know, I was an infielder coming up, and now I'm responsible for developing outfielders for one of the best organizations in professional baseball. And that is a result of, at that point, 7 years of them getting to know me and understanding that, hey, even though this isn't necessarily my area of expertise, they know my core values, they know my makeup and character, and they knew that if I were to take it on, that I would approach it no different than how I've approached everything else. And it got me out of my comfort zone, and it helped me grow into a more well-rounded coach. And, you know, so whatever the next steps are for me, who's to say what that's going to be? But, you know, at this point, it's just trying to be as good of a minor league coordinator as I can, and everything else will kind of fall into place.
Well, may we bless you, please, with a lineup of Benintendi, Chavis, Devers, Moncada, and have Kopech in your rotation, just like you did back in 2015 with the Greenville Drive. I'm sure that made it a little bit easier, but we'll put you on that ML staff with them. It'll be easy peasy.
Yeah, that's a pretty good push button club right there. So we'll see, but it's not always as easy on the field as it may be on paper.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to wrap up here. And of course, you're listening to Diamond Conversations on the Place to Be Nation Network. If you want to follow me on social media, it's at Chad EMB. If you want to follow the producer extraordinaire statistician, it's at Doug Barclay 17. And if you want to follow Darren Fencer, I suggest it. It's at Coach Your Kids on Twitter. But I'm going to hand it over to you, Darren, and fill in the gaps of any place else the listeners want to find you and find more about your philosophy and coaching and everything you got going on.
No, that's all good. I also do some work for USA Baseball, you know, writing a blog for their educational arm. So, you know, that's just another branch of the game that I enjoy being a part of, that hits more of the grassroots stuff than, you know, than that top of the pyramid where, you know, my everyday attention generally takes me. So, yeah, you know, I'm not a huge social media guy, but I really, you know, Twitter is very much a cesspool, especially with where our society is right now. But, you know, there are positives that you could take from it. And I've chosen to use that medium as a way to share my passion and knowledge for the game, with, you know, the next generation of players and coaches. And, you know, it's been something that I've enjoyed. And, you know, aside from the random Twitter fights that you get into, you know, I think there's a lot of like-minded people out there who just are interested in talking the game and learning more about it. And, you know, I'm happy to be, you know, someone who tries to help push that forward.
The old school fights versus the new school guys, the hitting gurus versus the non-hitting gurus, the pitching, it's all over the place, and it's not limited to baseball, it's everything. So I can completely respect that. Well, the class of 1996 met the class of 2001, met the class of 2008 here in the Middletown South reunion on Diamond Conversations. So for the crew here today, this is Ian, and I will catch you next time.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture.